You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 2nd. 2022. Whoa! My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dorothy Roberts. Wow. Can't talk today. Professor of Law, Sociology, and Civil Rights at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Torn Apart, How the Child Welfare System Destroys Black Families, and How Abolition Can Build a Safer World. Meanwhile, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, there's been yet another mass shooting, this time in a medical building. Four have died, plus the shooter. CNN is reporting that an AR-15 was found on the scene and was reportedly purchased on the day of the actual shooting. There were multiple shootings happening at that very time. Same time during the Tulsa massacre. Speaking of other shootings, there's so many. The Buffalo white supremacist has been indicted on over 24 charges, including a domestic terrorism charge. The baby formula shortage rages on. The Biden administration has announced that new shipments of formula will be airlifted from Europe as production continues to stall here in the U.S. Biden has still not broadly forgiven student loan debt, floating a means-tested plan to the media a few weeks ago. But he did just cancel $5.8 billion for over 500,000 borrowers who attended Corinthian Colleges, the for-profit education chain that defrauded them. The CDC is investigating the first reported case of monkeypox, which is fun to say, but doesn't sound like it's fun to have, in Georgia, so not good. In Ukraine, Zelensky says Russian forces have seized 20% of Ukrainian territory. Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine nears its 100th day. Israeli forces have reportedly shot and killed yet another journalist in the occupied West Bank just weeks after the IDF murdered Shireen Abu Akleh. And lastly, Politico has obtained recordings of meetings about the GOP's, quote, precinct strategy, deputizing Republican operatives at Democratic polling stations to question people's identification. So voter intimidation en masse should be expected in the fall. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. John in Omaha writes in, a majority hangover after the big win last night. I did have some red wine, won't lie, but I mean, look, the Rangers are up one. The Rangers are seven wins from winning the Stanley Cup. And that's, the last time they won was 1994. That was the year of my birth. And they went in high school, when I was in college, they went to the Stanley Cup final and lost. And that was like a lot of tears were shed. So we'll see. We'll see. But I would not say it constitutes a hangover, just a bit of a distracted day for that reason. But let's turn to this Mitch McConnell clip. I'm really excited for our conversation with Dorothy Roberts. Her book is phenomenal, and she's done so much research on this topic for many, many years. But we still have to talk about gun violence in this country. As I mentioned yesterday, there was yet another mass shooting. In fact, there were shootings happening at the same time as this Tulsa massacre in a medical building. CNN is reporting that an AR-15-style firearm was found on the premises of the medical building, and that it was purchased the day of the shooting. So in the morning, ostensibly, the shooter goes, gets their weapon, Also, apparently, there was also a handgun found on the scene, purchased on May 29th, so just days before. And in the afternoon, does a mass shooting, because that's how it works in America. Here is Mitch McConnell yesterday, though, talking about mass shootings. And he mentions the root causes, in his estimation, of school shootings in particular. Notice what he leaves out. Obviously.
It seems to me there are two broad categories that underscore the problem. Mental illness and school safety. So hopefully we can find a way to come together and make some progress on this horrendous problem, consistent with our Constitution and with our values.
Bradley, can you pull up all... No, I'm doing a joke. Bradley, can you pull up, this is a Sam-style joke, all of the times that Mitch McConnell has proposed funding for mental health facilities and healthcare in this country? There's got to be a long list, right? No, not the case. So I would love to address mental health care in this country. I would love for Medicare for All to include wide access and payments for therapy, mental health care, et cetera. All of these, the gaps in filling all of the gaps in this country where therapy is, frankly, for a lot of people, a luxury item.
Yeah, unless you're wealthy, you're price discriminated out of having a therapist.
I would love for that to be more widely expanded. So Mitch McConnell, let's work together. Obviously.
Medicare for All would do that.
Yeah, but does he support Medicare for All? Does he support any bill that promulgates healthcare in this country, let alone mental healthcare? And the reality is that's not the case. What they're going to do is say, oh, it's a crisis of the kinds of things that young kids are consuming, like pornography, like weed. Laura Ingraham going on television saying,
wait till you hear Weinstein.
Oh, I haven't seen that clip yet, so we'll get to that in the fun half. But that's what it's going to be. It's going to be a restricting on substances or, I mean, they're not really going to do anything, but that will be the rhetoric. It's all the culture. It's all what's being consumed. Yeah. And just but not the thing that's being purchased, which is the guns.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. Like they always say, like, it's not political in a post-Citizens United world where they are taking money from a political lobbying arm of that commodity weapon.
And let's be clear. Mitch McConnell takes a ton of money from the gun lobby and has benefited greatly from their financial resources in his career. So he mentioned school safety there. I'm not sure if that was before the Tulsa shooting. I think it was. How about hospital safety? We need Republican politicians on it today. One-door policy for hospitals. Only buildings can only have one point of entry in general. Let's make every building in this country a prison, essentially. No windows, one door. And then we can prevent mass shooting. I mean, it's so silly.
As they laugh at the idea that we would, like, retrofit old buildings to be more sort of less carbon intensive.
It's such a great point. Yeah, exactly. That's socialism. But this is just common sense gun safety. There have been 233 mass shootings in 2022, according to the Gun Violence Archive. That means that we are averaging well over one mass shooting a day right now, because June 1st, yesterday, is the 152nd day of the year, 153rd today. I mean, we had multiple yesterday. And to be clear on the methodology, the Gun Violence Archive defines mass shooting as one that kills four or more people, not including the shooter. So it's just, yeah.
And it ultimately, it has to be, I think, a federal sort of ban on the manufacture and making of this sort of implement. Like Beto O'Rourke in Texas, you know, you can say, like, we don't want these things sold in Texas, but that implies that they're sold somewhere else. And guess what? We don't have hard borders in states.
Yeah.
That's why there's so much gun violence in places like Illinois and stuff like that.
Right.
We need to, like, I understand folks who have like the old fashioned Second Amendment, like should be able to have like a shotgun and a rifle for hunting and stuff like that. But I frankly don't have a problem with massive just. We have to control these manufacturers and tell them, no, you cannot sell this stuff.
Yeah.
You can't even make it. If we need it for the military, which, by the way, we should take a look at those arms controls as well, then we'll talk to you. But this is not a consumer product.
I said that you mentioned the military. I said this before on the show this week. It is not a surprise that the United States, which is an empire that's bloated and dying, that relies on sustaining its primacy through brute force and military action, has a bloated military budget, and can't provide basic necessities for its citizens, that the way, since that's the way that the country flexes its muscle and exerts its power, that the citizenry, on an individual level, wraps up their identity in that kind of consumerism. That's why part of why it's so hard to break is because it's unfortunately incredibly American.
There's a couple things. There's one, it's a thing you can use to kill people, but it also is like, it is just a commodity fetish. It is like some guys read gun magazines and go on gun forums and talk about just endless different specifications and different types of guns they might buy in the future. The same way other people go on like guitar forums and look at guitar equipment and stuff like that. Except there's a deeper sickness when it comes to like it's motivated by fear and hate. I think ultimately when you're talking about fetishizing weapons of war, and it just shouldn't be allowed. That's something the market just shouldn't be able to provide, be allowed to provide for.
And it didn't from 94 to 2004. And it expired, the assault weapons ban, which did have gaps in it, but it sunsetted and no one had the courage to, because of the lobbying of the NRA, among other groups, to bring it back up again. That should be the bare minimum. I want an assault weapons ban yesterday. And I understand that there's a lot of guns already in this country, more guns than people, and it's highly concentrated among collectors and people who fetishize this stuff, as Matt says. But we should offer a very lucrative buyback program for these kinds of assault weaponry and any guns for that matter. Doesn't need to be mandated. I'm sure in the end, if this ever happens, the right wing will say, mandate! It's just like the vaccine mandate. It's not a mandate. But that can be a way to start.
At a certain point, I think we talked about this on Left Reckoning. I think you expand something like the Game and Fish Department to be basically the DMV of guns. And they're the ones who are going to shooting ranges, making sure no one's modified.
They already regulate.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we know that. And like, if you've ever been hunting, you've known that wardens will come up to you and check your licenses and stuff like that. So we should have them also go into gun ranges, making sure people aren't modifying weapons in ways that are unsafe. And I think like Trudeau's announced some sort of buyback. I'm not sure the details, but my understanding is he said that if you choose to keep your guns, they'll be functionally unusable. And like, I think that is the sort of thing, right? Ultimately, I don't think you're ever going to be able to go door to door or know
right.
Is that sort of politically desirable, because I think it'd be an absolute disaster. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I think you can ban the manufacture of these things entirely, and it's just insane that AR-15s have been rolling off the production line all this time since Sandy Hook.
It's unbelievable. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be joined by Dorothy Roberts. We are back, and we are joined here by Dorothy Roberts, professor of law, sociology, and civil rights at the University of Pennsylvania, and author of Torn Apart, How the Child Welfare System Destroys Black Families and How Abolition Can Build a Safer World, among many other books. Dorothy, thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks, Emma.
Of course. So your work on this topic extends multiple decades at this point. You've been covering this for quite a while. What made you decide that you needed to write this update or this new book on the child welfare system, which you can't really call it that. You call it family policing.
Right. Yeah, I prefer to call it what it actually is, a family policing system, because it's never been designed truly to care for children's welfare. I wrote a book now 21 years ago called Shattered Bonds, the Color of Child Welfare, where I documented the huge racial inequities in the system and also made the claim that it was a form of oppression of Black communities. And now 20 years later, I decided it was time to write a new book, partly because I had worked on trying to engage in reform efforts to improve this system, you know, to make it less harmful over those 20 years, including working on a big class action lawsuit settlement in Washington State for 9 years. Also, I became more of an abolitionist over those 20 years. I learned more about abolitionist principles and the movement to undo and replace the prison industrial complex. And I understood better over those 20 years how we cannot reform the system. It has to be completely dismantled. And then also there's been a growing movement to abolish family policing that I've been involved in. And so I thought this is a time where we need to point out the system cannot be reformed. And I wanted to support the growing movement to completely dismantle it and replace it with an approach that truly cares for children, keeps them safe, and supports families.
How did prison abolition, defund, all of these growing movements kind of feed and help your personal journey on this, but also expand the movement and of family policing abolition?
Well, first, it's important to understand that these systems, whether we're talking about the prison industrial complex or we're talking about what's called the child welfare system or foster care, I prefer to call them the family policing system and the foster industrial complex, are part of one giant carceral apparatus. They work in the same ways. They accuse, investigate, blame, punish people in the very same communities, primarily impoverished, segregated Black neighborhoods and also indigenous communities. It's the same targets. And also they work to pretend to meet human needs and solve social conflicts by punishing the people who are most burdened and disadvantaged by structural inequities. So they operate in the same way. They also operate hand in hand. And so by understanding that we're talking about one carceral apparatus, it makes sense then for movements that are trying to abolish policing, you know, by criminal law enforcement and prisons, also understand that family policing and the foster industrial complex are supported by the same ideologies and work together. So it makes sense to have, if not a joint movement, you know, coordinated movements to abolish them.
It's also, you know, it's an extension, all of them together, of white supremacy and of slavery. Black children were regularly, of course, separated from their parents during slavery. Can you talk a little bit about tracing the child welfare infrastructure back to systems of slavery, oppression, colonialism, as well, when we're talking about indigenous families, because as we know, Deb Haaland and the Biden administration right now, they're looking into these schools of where they separated and What's the term, Matt? The indigenous schools?
Oh, residential schools.
Residential schools.
Residential schools. Yeah, so that's another commonality between the prison industrial complex and the foster industrial complex. They have a common history rooted in settler colonialism and genocide of indigenous peoples, but also with enslaving African people and the same racial capitalist industry that supported and was fueled by settler colonialism and enslavement. So in the case of the child welfare system, which is often overlooked, its roots go back to the use of family separation as a tool, as a weapon of controlling these communities. And so, of course, during the slavery era, Black families had no legal rights whatsoever. The children were owned as chattel property by enslavers, and enslavers had total authority over those children. And of course, they separated families at their whim whenever it was economically advantageous for them, or to punish and quell rebellions by Black people, or at the auction block, different enslavers could purchase different family members separately. So the idea that white people should have authority over Black families is deeply rooted in enslavement. But I think what's even more close to and a tighter root, you know, direct root of our family policing system today is the apprenticeship of Black children after the Civil War. This was the time, and abolitionists have pointed this out, where white supremacists, you know, who dominated the South, wanted to regain control of the South, and they destroyed Reconstruction efforts by effectively re-enslaving Black people through Black codes, the convict leasing system. These are the roots of mass incarceration today. But part of it that often gets overlooked is court-ordered apprenticeships of Black children back to former white enslavers. And this was done by judges who deemed that Black parents were neglectful, just like judges do today, and ruled that children should be indentured to former white enslavers. Sometimes the very men who enslaved them, they were put back to work under this court-ordered apprenticeship system. So at this very same time, in the 19th century, the U.S. government was waging so-called Indian wars against Native tribes to dispossess them of their land. And the military began a military campaign. This was a strategy of war of removing Native children from their families and putting them initially in military barracks. You know, again, this is a weapon of war. This then led in the 20th century to the U.S. government's policy of removing Native children from their homes on grounds of neglect. This was in conjunction with the Child Welfare League of America, and placing them in white-run orphanages or to be adopted by white families. So it's really important to understand that the system we have today was always designed to regulate and punish and dispossess and disrupt and destroy families in Black and Native communities. And it's not a coincidence, it's no accident that those are the very communities that are most likely to be disrupted by family policing today.
It is. It's white paternalism, right? And it's also working in conjunction with this, as you say, settler colonialism, and by extension, you know, Christian conversion, right? I mean, yes. Churches, obviously nakedly so in the case of these indigenous children, but also just in the underlying reform of promoting orphanages and taking kids away, often penalizing them for poverty.
Yeah.
You will be a part of civilized America and civilized society. Can you talk about the those orphanages and that concept, particularly in the 19th and 20th centuries?
Yeah, so overall, the system has always been a system for impoverished families. There's, you know, even if you don't take into account the kind of weapon of child removal and family separation used against Black and Indigenous communities, which of course we have to do, but even those who ignore that have to take into account that it has always been designed from its inception in the Elizabethan poor laws to address the wants, the deprivations caused by society of impoverished families. And so it's important to understand that it is a system for poor people and it punishes poverty. It always has, and it does today. Today, in through the very definition of neglect, which is usually conflated with poverty, it's simply parents who are unable to meet the needs, the material needs of their children. So I want to highlight that aspect of it. But it's been framed from the beginning as a child-saving enterprise. The idea that Christian organizations or other charitable organizations are going into homes to rescue abused and deprived children from their families. And this is the what I call a benevolent terror, because what they're actually doing is invading people's homes and terrorizing them with accusations, investigations, and the trauma of child removal. But it's painted as if this is some kind of benevolent act by the government or by Christian organizations or other charitable organizations to save these children. I think that is still the dominant view in America of what the child welfare system does. And it is extremely effective in propaganda at getting people to ignore the obvious and well-documented harms to children.
Yeah, and it also strips Black people, non-white people of agency. I mean, both literally, but also in the way that they're presented, which is that they are purely victims that we're going to fetishize, frankly. It's like the picture of the Christian missionary girl going to Africa and using kids as props while they're doing charity work. You know, that's part of the other troubling. There's so many troubling aspects, but for me, it's the treatment of Black kids and families as if they are merely chess pieces and don't have agency of their own.
That's right. That they don't have agency and they shouldn't have agency. I think underlying this system and part of the reason it's been perpetuated and still remains so popular, despite people recognizing all the flaws and all the harms, but how does it still then maintain its popularity that people think, oh, we have to have it to protect children, to save children? I think a large part of it is because of this white supremacist idea that Black people don't really care about their children and they are incapable of taking good care of their children. So it deprives Black families of agency, like you said, literally by taking their children away from them and then monitoring them intensively. You know, what happens when your children are removed? When you're threatened with child removal, is that the agency gives you a list of mandated tasks. And usually on the list is parental training, because the whole idea is, oh, the problems your children are having is that you're not a good enough parent. So we'll train you to be a better parent. Again, this very paternalistic, ridiculous, really attitude. Yeah. But so it literally does that. But it also... It's not empathetic toward the parents as if, we feel sorry for you. We're going to help you. It's you are, especially Black mothers, you are incapable of being a good parent. I mean, just think about the long list of stereotypes about Black women. Almost all of them. I don't even know if I should say all. They all paint Black women as innately bad mothers, you know, sexually promiscuous, the Black Jezebel. Even the mammy who took care of white people's children was supposed to be neglectful of her own children and didn't care about her own children. She just, you know, was dutiful toward white children. Of course, then she also had to be supervised by white women. She wasn't really in charge of those children. She just cared for them. And then there's the welfare queen who was supposed to have children just to get a welfare check. And that was so popular that even when you say welfare queen, you know it's a Black woman. You know that she doesn't really care about her children. She has children to rip off white taxpayers. And then she doesn't spend the money on them. She spends it on herself. And then there was the Black crack addict who was supposed to trade sex for crack, again, had babies because of her crack addiction, and then was supposed to transmit this depraved lifestyle to her children who were so-called crack babies. Again, you don't have to say Black crack babies because everybody knew they were Black babies who were predicted to lack social consciousness and go off to be welfare dependents and criminals and be a menace to society. So, and I could go on with others, but all of these stereotypes, which I'm sure as I say this, people listening, they're identifiable to everybody in America. They're so present. They're so powerful. And every single one of those stereotypes has profoundly shaped policy in the United States. I mean, it shaped the policy toward drug use during pregnancy or being pregnant and using drugs to a criminal activity to addressed by prosecuting pregnant women or new mothers. It led to the abolition of the federal entitlement to welfare under a Democratic administration, under Bill Clinton. It led to, in fact, we could look at the trifecta of the crime control bill, the restructuring of welfare, and the Adoption and Safe Families Act, all in the span of the 1990s.
Let's do that. I mean, we just had someone, I don't mean to cut you off, but we had someone write in, Brooklyn Sue. I worked at family court in the Bronx in the mid-90s, and the court officers had a motto for the institution. You make them, we take them. That is how prevalent this was, and particularly the
and is.
I misspoke because I want to talk to you about how the next step of this is going to be when Roe v. Wade's appealed in weeks. If Black women are not perfect earthly vessels for their children, there's going to be more, drug testing, criminalization of mothers, which still happens to this day. But could you expand on how, particularly in the 80s and 90s, Bill Clinton, particularly, but also Reagan, how their presidency set up the infrastructure for a rapid increase in the kind of carceral systems that you describe.
Right. Well, we do, again, we could start earlier, but let's start with Ronald Reagan. Reagan is the one who promoted the Black welfare queen myth and also began this, as I said, trifecta of crime control, intense crime control directed at Black communities. The idea that there had to be a war on drugs and crime, that meant intensifying police surveillance and incursions into Black communities. The beginning of the unraveling of the federal entitlement to welfare and also massive increase in the foster care population because more and more Black families were getting access to welfare benefits. We see this backlash against it. This actually began in the 60s. I mean, we can see it as a backlash against the civil rights movement, but it intensified over the 80s and 90s, leading to a huge buildup, skyrocketing of the foster care population and astronomical gaps in the numbers of Black children removed from their homes versus white children. So it was the increase in a punitive approach focusing on child removal as opposed to providing services to families in their homes, all on the backs of Black families. And so then we see in the 1990s under Bill Clinton, this a neoliberal white supremacist approach, which is relying on the market to take care of families. And if you can't make it to remove children from their homes, and with the Adoption Safe Families Act, prioritizing adoption. It's in the title of the law passed in 1997, a year after the welfare restructuring law. And we have to see all of this together, which is a punitive approach to the families who are most disadvantaged by locking them up and taking their children away, at the same time that we have a welfare law that's basically a behavior modification under this myth that what Black women need to do to solve poverty in Black communities is take low-wage work, get married, and stop having so many babies. So along with welfare restructuring, our so-called family caps or child exclusion policies passed in many states that deny any increase in benefits to mothers who have babies after they're already receiving welfare. Okay, so for the first time in U.S. history, we have this confluence of the war on drugs and intensive police incursions, skyrocketing mass incarceration, no entitlement to federal aid to take care, or state aid, no entitlement to government aid to take care of children, and a mandate in the Adoption Safe Families Act that you must terminate parental rights after a sped up amount of time, and bonuses, literal bonuses to states to increase adoption. Have I connected the dots? You know, this is a base, and all of this based on, the idea that Black mothers, you know, fueled by Black mothers being the cause of all these problems, having children that are destined to be welfare cheats and criminals, and focusing on child removal. And one thing I left out, I mentioned it earlier, at the same time, we have this new form of criminalization of pregnancy. And yes, it's true that there have been, since the Casey decision, there's been an assault on the access to abortion care. And with the Casey decision, the ability of states to pass laws designed to keep people from getting abortions. And we see now with the Mississippi and other state laws, but the Mississippi law before the U.S. Supreme Court basically ban abortion, and the threat that Roe v. Wade will be overturned. At the same time, though, and this is why I'm focusing on how the criminalization of Black mothers is so important to this debate today, we begin to see in the late 1980s the prosecutions of Black women for being pregnant and using drugs. It began with prosecutions of Black women, and that has then opened up fetal protection laws, and not just prosecutions of women for using drugs while pregnant, but prosecutions of women for homicide, for miscarriages and stillbirths. And we see a real confluence of laws that criminalize pregnancy broadly, whether it's for having a stillbirth, whether it's for having a miscarriage, whether it's for using abortion pills, whether it's for getting an abortion from a doctor. These are all one joint misogynistic right-wing assault on our freedom, reproductive freedom. And it is really a shame that people, you know, the movement for reproductive rights didn't see that this was one concerted assault. It's not just legal bans on abortion services. It is an assault on pregnancy altogether, and the criminalization of Black women in the late 80s into the 1990s helped to fuel this situation we're in now, where we are at risk of massive criminal prosecutions and other kinds of punishment of people for pregnancy. And of course, that is connected to, you know, what I wrote about in Torn Apart. It's part of a white supremacist, racial capitalist, and misogynistic, sexist, patriarchal, heterosexist attempt to control women and other pregnant people as well. But I see it as a assault on, it's racist and sexist and heterosexist altogether, assault on our freedoms.
Yeah, and what makes this so chilling, frankly, and you connect it to the present day, is that the reason the child tax credit expired, one of the many reasons, but the justification for it from Joe Manchin was, they're going to spend this money on drugs. That's what this is. Yes. It's the exact same thing. And that child tax credit could have been, that was a recognition, you know, that we have fallen so far in that way, and that, you know, child poverty is a massive problem in this country. Mm-hmm. And instead of penalizing kids for their poverty, perhaps we should attempt to alleviate it. I don't know. Crazy idea. And it went away because of those racist tropes used as justification by Joe Manchin.
Exactly. White supremacy, racism, these racist stereotypes about Black mothers are a major, if not the major, barrier against the kind of radical change we need in America to truly meet people's human needs. And here again, the family policing system plays a critical role because it puts all the blame on parents and family caregivers for the needs, you know, not meeting the needs of their children. This is a critical aspect of this, because what is the answer then to childhood poverty in America? It's take impoverished children, especially if they're Black or Indigenous, away from their parents and put them in the foster care system and pretend that maybe adoption will be a solution. And it's very interesting that Justice Coney Barrett and also Alito, in a reference, especially a particular footnote in the Dobbs leaked opinion, point to adoption as the answer to banning abortion, that women who are pregnant can just drop off their babies at safe havens and they'll be adopted. Isn't it interesting that also, here's another tie, that also is the answer that people give for how the family policing system will save impoverished children? Take them from their parents who can't meet their needs and put them in foster care, and let's incentivize getting them adopted. Of course, it's all a fake pretense of what will actually end childhood poverty in America. But that pretense convinces so many people that we need this system, and this system is going to save impoverished children, especially impoverished Black and Native children, when in fact, what we need are the kinds of policies that provide the income, the housing, the medical care, the education, the kinds of material resources that children need. And we should direct the billions and billions of dollars that's spent on separating children from their families and maintaining them in a harmful, you know, well-documented, harmful foster industrial complex, and spend that money on simply giving income to people that they need to raise children, in addition to supporting community-based mutual aid and other kinds of resource providing services and programs and other ways of actually, you know, meeting children's needs and supporting families and keeping children safe.
Some of the numbers cited in your book are just insane. More than half of Black children in the United States will be the subject of, or are the subject of an investigation by the family policing system. Yes. Something you describe, which I, as a white person, I never thought of it, but that it's just, it, there's an ingrained fear of, you know, maybe Child Protective Services will come to my home in some, in Black families. And the figure for white children, it's around 28%, I have written down, but that's nearly double for black kids in the country.
That's right. So, yes, and let me emphasize again, a recent study that found that more than half, 53% of Black children in America will experience a child welfare investigation by the time they reach age 18. That is a huge number. And in case people don't realize it, a child welfare investigation is traumatic by itself. Even if children aren't removed, there's the threat that caseworkers and police, often accompanied by police, are going to forcibly remove children from their home. So that threat is hanging over the family during the investigation. They search every corner of the house. They inspect refrigerators, cabinets, closets. They interrogate children separately. They sometimes strip search children to look for evidence of abuse. These are really traumatic experiences. And just the idea that in America, Black families are seen as so risky that half of Black children would need to be investigated, that just tells you something about the devaluation of Black families in America. And then on top of that, it is a different kind of experience than for Black children. This is something that I think the statistics don't bear out. We know that Black children are much more likely to be taken from their families. We know, you know, these investigations are more likely, but it also means that they're concentrated in Black neighborhoods. And so if you know, you could get a map of a big city and look at where child welfare investigations take place, you know, they'll put pinpoints to show where they are. It almost always maps exactly onto where the most segregated Black neighborhoods are. It maps onto where there are high levels of incarceration, you know, high levels of poverty. It's all concentrated in these neighborhoods. And that means that everybody in the neighborhood is aware of this system. I did a study in Woodlawn, a Black neighborhood in Chicago, to look into this. And everyone I interviewed called it the system, you know, the Department of Children and Family Services, the system. It was so ubiquitous and prevalent in this neighborhood that it was the system in their lives. And everybody knew about it. Everyone had some contact with somebody. Either they'd been removed or their children had been removed or their friends had been removed or their cousins had been removed or they were taking care of a child who had been removed and put in their care as a kinship foster caregiver. Or they had been retaliated against by a neighbor or an ex-boyfriend who called the child abuse hotline on them to get revenge. You know, it was involved in everybody's lives. And there was no neighborhood in Chicago that was predominantly white that had anywhere near that amount of involvement. Everybody knows that, you know, in a white middle class or affluent neighborhood, people just have no experience with the system. But if you go into a Black segregated neighborhood, I would venture to say that everybody or close to everybody is going to be able to tell you a story. And that means that children understand that they're at risk of being taken from their parents, little kids. They know, you know, they know the caseworkers, they know the van. They could identify when the van comes into the neighborhood. Oh, that's, you know, that's the system coming in. Somebody's kids are going to be taken away.
And indigenous families as well, we should also add. Yeah,
absolutely. That too, indigenous families as well have this very common experience. And I don't think that we have come to grips at all with what kind of impact that has, the traumatizing impact, the impact on relationships between children and their parents, the sense of family security. And we're not, you know, this is apart from all the harms when your child is taken from you and put into a harmful foster care system, where also we know that Black children fare worse than any other children who, and, you know, on average, all children who are in foster care on average have poor outcomes. There are exceptions, but the outcomes in terms of college attendance, income, homelessness, emotional and mental health issues are all bad.
That makes sense. I mean, given the fact that it's traumatic to be taken from your families and I'm reminded of another racist trope of where are the fathers, right? But there's all these intersecting and frankly layers of, if you escape these systems of breaking apart families and criminalization, you're lucky, honestly, because it's so stacked against you in Black communities. And you know, you wrote about this story that I remembered only because I saw it on social media a few years ago. It was the name of the American Idol contestant. I'm trying to find it here in my notes.
Saisha
Mercado, right? Who went viral because basically her baby was having trouble transitioning to solid foods. Someone reported her baby as being malnourished, and
she brought the baby to the hospital for help. This was her toddler, her 13-month-old toddler. She was pregnant, and so she was trying to transition her little boy to solid foods so she would be ready to breastfeed the baby. And when she brought him to a St. Petersburg hospital, they declared that he was failing to thrive and malnourished, and they took custody of the child. Now, to make matters worse, I mean, that's bad enough. Again, it just gives you an example of how this system operates, that you go for help and you get punished for it. I mean, just imagine what that means in terms of people's willingness to seek help. This is one of the problems of it. It turns service providers, teachers, doctors, social service providers into enemies, you know, into government agents that threaten to take your children away. What sense does that make in supporting families?
And it must have a chilling effect, too, because not to cut you off, in terms of yesterday we had a doctor from Alabama come on to talk about how she felt intimidated in terms of miscarriage procedures because of the Alabama laws and how stifling that can be. And it can work for Black families as well. They're not going to want to seek help for a child struggling to get onto solid foods if they feel that they're going to be targeted by the state. It's completely sensical.
Yes, of course. You're not going to, and there's studies that show this, refraining to really reveal struggles that you have to a teacher, to a doctor, to a social service worker, because of the fear that it'll trigger an investigation and your children will be taken from you. This also operates, and again, documented in the case of domestic violence, because many systems remove children when their mothers call for help for ending violence in the home. Even if the child has never seen the violence, has never experienced the violence, the idea is that this mother is risky because she is surviving violence. Now, that, of course, deters many women from seeking help because they don't want their children taken from them. Not because they're selfish, because they care about their children. They don't want their children put into foster care. So it works that way as well. And so this system is set up in a way that takes the opportunities of having community-based, caring, supportive hubs, you know, where people can go to get help, and turning them into just the opposite, deputized agents for the state. And by the way, I should add that this only happens to impoverished people, especially in, again, Black and Native people. It doesn't happen when affluent white people go to their doctor with a problem. You know, they, let's say they have a child with an eating disorder. They go and get help for it. They don't have to fear that caseworkers are going to knock on the door and take their child away from them because they sought help. So, you know, I like to point out that the idea that mandated reporting is protecting children and that these professionals feel they have to call CPS on families is just not true, because they don't call CPS, Child Protective Services, on affluent families. They only serve as agents for family policing of the most marginalized families. And if I could just, do we have time? I just wanted to
go ahead.
Conclude what happened to Saisha Mercado, because it didn't just end with them taking her son. After her baby was born, because now she's been labeled by the system as a risky mother, a judge ordered that sheriffs come and pick up, it's called a pickup order, her newborn baby. And fortunately, her partner Instagrammed live what happened when the Manatee County Sheriff's Department surrounded, you know, pulled her car over. She's sitting in the back with this 10-day-old baby, and they came, surrounded the car, armed officers accompanied by some caseworkers, and demanded that she give up the baby. And they took her baby, breastfeeding, newborn baby, no evidence that there was any harm to this baby, and kept the child for 9 days. Now, fortunately, she had a social media presence. She had high-powered lawyers. You know, there was a video of it. But imagine if she didn't have any of that. I guarantee you they would have kept that baby. That baby might have ended up staying in foster care for years. And this happens all the time. This isn't unusual. This happened to be videotaped, but this is the way in which the system operates to really degrade and devalue Black families and traumatize. What was the point of holding that newborn baby for 9 days? There's just no way you could say they protected the baby at all. They traumatized and harmed the entire family, including this baby. And imagine if they hadn't gotten her back and she ends up kept at a hospital in the care of strangers. You know, it really is a traumatizing, terroristic system that, again, as you can see here, is in cahoots with law enforcement, terrorizing families and blaming them for what is caused by structural racism, then blaming them for the needs children have. And we need to replace it with ways that we know benefit children much more. We know that increasing income, for example, of impoverished families is the best way to improve the welfare of impoverished children. That's so well documented. It's obvious. We shouldn't have to do studies, but it's so well documented. And yet, as you pointed out, that's unpopular in the United States. We try it out, and then there's an effort to cut it off as soon as possible,
right,
despite the fact that studies showed, it lifted, you know, millions of children out of poverty. And we know that that benefits children, but let's cut that off. Meantime, we'll continue to have this harmful system, again, well-documented, to harm children that doesn't actually address the roots of the problem.
Well, I can't thank you enough for your time today, Dorothy Roberts, professor of law, sociology, and civil rights at the University of Pennsylvania, and author of Torn Apart, How the Child Welfare System Destroys Black Families and How Abolition Can Build a Safer World. Dorothy, thanks so much for your time today. Great discussion.
Oh, thanks, Emma. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Of course. Me too. All right. With that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program. Although I am seeing, I'm seeing a bunch of IMs about this. Emma's Cashews writes in, "Hey, Emma Jordy crew, I like Nomi and think she'd be a great senator, but are you worried about the chance she splits the left vote with Kirsten Gonzalez and Crowley gets elected? Gonzalez already got endorsed by AOC, DSA, and the Working Families Party, so why should I support a candidate when the rest of the institutional left is backing another leftist poggers?" It's a great point. It's a great point. Look, yesterday, I did not know that Nomi was running in a district with Kirsten Gonzalez and this, who's backed by DSA, one of this historically large number of DSA endorsed candidates in the upcoming elections here in New York. I wish I had known that, frankly. You know, Nomiki's a friend of the show, and she's gonna, you know, it's her choice to run. But I really don't have an answer for how that.
I got a lot of those messages too. I didn't anticipate that conflict, and perhaps I should have. I haven't looked closely at the candidates yet,
right,
other than to know that they exist.
And frankly, I was a little confused because the districts had just been redrawn, so it was hard to keep track for me.
Yeah.
But
look, this is nothing personal to Nomi. It's that I support DSA candidates. This is true if DSA put in somebody against, you know, my buddy Chris running in Dallas. He didn't run as a DSA candidate. I would have supported DSA over him because of that ideological reason. And I think, like, look, I think there's certain folks who say, like, this is democracy and, you know, win. And I kind of, in a vacuum, can relate to that and, like, see the best candidate win. But, you know, you do have that Crowley vote split issue. And you do have the entire rest of the left lining up behind Kirsten Gonzalez, who I think looks like a really good candidate. And who I'm probably going to donate to. So, yeah, it's a, we've heard the criticisms, and
very valid, very valid, frankly.
And I think that's like the challenge probably for Nomiki's campaign is how do you, like, that's a huge concern. And I don't share like some, I guess, assessment of limitations of DSA that maybe Nomiki does. And I guess I don't want to be seen as hostile to DSA, particularly as I really like that organization.
Frankly,
and
because
the work that they're doing.
Yeah, I do too. Frankly, because before this news about Nomi, I'd praise the DSA slate. So I just want to be transparent that I was not aware of that conflict yesterday. And I think some of these questions can go towards Nomiki directly, but I think that it's valid to ask these questions 100%.
Yeah.
All right, folks, with that, we are going to head into the fun half. But first, I want to bring in Matt Binder.
Oh, sorry. We might need to take a break.
Okay, we need to take a break.
Okay, they're here. Let me...
Matt's...
I'm just going to take a 30-second break, see if I can get them on.
Yeah. Quick break.
Okay.
We are back here with Binder and Brandon. What's up, guys?
B&B.
Hey, how are you?
What's happening over on Doomed and Scam Economy, Matt?
Sure. On Doom this past week, I actually did something different. I teamed up with Lance from the Serfs. He'd invited me to join him to have a little discussion with these two centrist, sort of conservative-leaning centrists, I guess they would call themselves. I don't know, Adam and Sitch or Sitch and Adam. And we had a discussion for like a few hours about a range of topics. And people seem to have really enjoyed it or really hated it. It seems like it went either way. So you could tune in to youtube.com/Matt Binder and check that out. I'll be putting up the audio shortly for that at doomedcast.com, wherever you listen to podcasts. And then tonight on Scam Economy, I will be airing the Scam Economy live show that was live in Brooklyn last Thursday. Just getting around, well, they just got me all the audio and video and put it all together, and it's looking good. And Michael Edison Hayden of the Southern Poverty Law Center joins me to discuss how, you know, Bitcoin and crypto is being used by some of the worst people on the planet, from, you know, Alex Jones to Stefan Molyneux to the Daily Stormer, etc., etc. So scameconomy.com for that. And also it'll be airing at youtube.com/Matt Binder as well, 9 p.m. Eastern time tonight.
Awesome. Brandon, what's happening on the discourse, if anything at all?
Well, the boys were off for Memorial Day, and I like to respect that and respect the right to workers to take off.
Right.
Cough, cough. But no, we'll have a new episode up for you by the end of the week, maybe sooner, regarding the epidemic of shootings that is gripping our fair nation.
Oh, all right. And Matt,
some hot takes.
What happened on Left Reckoning last night?
Yeah, we had Alex Presson talk about Dollar General workers being fed up, and we talked for an hour on guns. David and I just going back and forth about, you know, different concerns we have about how we end up policing this thing if we do move forward, but also granting that like something needs to be done about this sort of thing, and the state is credible to do it, and just what kind of things we can try to funnel them towards. So, an hour-long discussion about guns with Griscom and I, and talk with Alex Press about Dollar General workers. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning, where we get into this Elon Musk clip that I think we're also going to play in this fun app.
All right. Well, yes. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Who? What is up, everyone?
Nomi Keen.
You did it! Let's go, Brandon!
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? Oh, no sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go try.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop. You can call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundial Guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.